Renee and worship team, and thank you, Paula, for that really moving testimony. What can save us from our desires to be seen as good people? It's a different that's a question that's on my mind today. Not what can save us from our desires to be good people, but what can save us from our desires to be seen as good people? And what can save our church from a desire to be seen as the good kind of Christian church? Those are questions that are feeling very personal to me at the moment, and they're questions that came up a lot for me in reading this week's lectionary passage in 1 Kings 8. We've been working through the lectionary this summer, which are the sort of ordering of the Bible in a way that each week we're reading the same passages as many of our brothers and sisters around the world are. In 1 Kings 8, I was glad to find that chapter in today's lectionary. I'm going to stay kind of big picture about 1 Kings 8 and try to tell the story. We're only going to actually get scripture up on the screen for one little part that's actually the same verse on the cover of your bulletin. I want to give some big picture and kind of slowly zoom in on that and these questions I started with. 1 and 2 Kings are a really sad story. I mean, they're the ancient Jewish texts that tell the story of all the kings that Israel had after the rise of their first great king, King David. And as y'all probably remember, what makes it sad is that one by one, these kings really fail to live up to their commitments. It's a sad story. It's a story that ends in the captivity, the return to slavery, really, for Israel. And in fact, 1 and 2 Kings is most likely written from that captivity in Babylon. And so I could only read these stories of all these kings through the lens of what went wrong? How did we get here? But 1 Kings chapter 8, today's chapter, is really not the sad part. It's a kind of pinnacle, right? It's a pinnacle for many people, the high point of all that came before and for some even all that came after. Because 1 Kings 8 is the story of the grand opening and dedication of the temple that King Solomon was able to build. It's an amazing culmination, really. If you think about God's story with us, as beginning with this promise to Abraham and Abraham's family, invited to wander, and a story that extends through Israel's escape from Egypt and then wandering more, dependent on God every morning to provide for them, a people beset from all sides. How does that story get to this, where this resplendent structure is dedicated that draws from resources from across the known world and then invites God to reside in it? This homeless people moves to that. It's an amazing culmination, and nothing, I don't want to say anything today to take away from that. It really is a pinnacle. But I found this 1 Kings 8 a good text to reflect on at this time for us for a few reasons. One is that it's a time of new beginnings for Israel, right? They have this, they finally have the temple. The Ark of the Covenant is secure in. The glory of the Lord has moved in. It's a time of new beginnings. And because so, this town is tied as much to education as it is, we're also at a time of new beginnings. Whether or not you are you're connected to teaching or education or have kids in school, everything about us in this town is kind of oriented to late August, early September being a time of new beginnings. Even we're going to start into some new teachings. We look to new people to be in town. So this felt like a good time to be thinking about new beginnings. And in fact, just as we're reading about this ceremony, I was part of a big ceremony a couple days ago to open the new year, right? So a bunch of people gathered in our local temple, right? This, State Farm Center, a.k.a. Assembly Hall. And the chancellor welcomed all the new students to town, this between 7,000 and 8,000 new people, our new neighbors in town. And it was a ceremony of new beginnings to launch us all. And I was up there on the stage this year behind the chancellor, which relates to another reason why 1 Kings 8 really stood out to me. As Renee mentioned, I find myself in a new position of leadership. And so just as 1 Kings 8 puts a king in the spotlight, I'm thinking about my own new role as dean of a college on campus and being in the spotlight. Solomon's long been a favorite of mine. I really remember as a kid reading that story of Solomon being granted anything he wanted from God and him choosing wisdom. And as a kid, that really struck me. I prayed for wisdom as a kid. I continue to pray for wisdom now. But a question that nags at me still is, do I really want wisdom, or do I want to be seen as the kind of person who, given a choice between everything, chooses wisdom? Right? Because then, and then gets everything else to boot. Right? It feels like this kind of secret way to actually get what you want is to say you want something that you're supposed to want. And so as much as I crave wisdom, I'm drawn to wisdom in others, I always have that question about that. How can I be saved from that? Do I really want to be seen, do I really want to be a good servant, a good leader? Or do I just want to be seen as the good kind of leader? You know, am I really the kind of leader that that is not going to hold on to power, but it's going to give it? I'm humbled by that question. And I think it relates to our church's questions, too. We want to serve as community, but do we? Do we want to be seen as the good kind of church? Or do we really want to serve? These kind of questions come up. And I think they're called into particular light with today's passage in chapter 8. Because though, yes, we should see the opening of the temple as, yes, the fulfillment of God's promise that there would be a temple. It is an example of a leader pointing for the nation to the true source of their well-being and their very life. There's also all this excess, right, in this story. All this gold, the riches, resplendent art and decoration, uncountable number of animal sacrifices. And so reading 1 Kings 8, I keep thinking, is this really all to glorify God, or is it also to kind of glorify Solomon who got to build this thing? And that's kind of the tension in this. I see 1 Kings 8 as actually able to take us to both those conclusions. And in fact, 1 Kings 8 helps us to navigate these struggles that I'm talking about for myself, or maybe even for our church. Because I think what 1 Kings 8 helps us see by capturing Solomon in that struggle, in his very prayer that we're going to look at, is that as we move towards those desires to be good leaders, good people, a servant church, we have to keep in mind the deep source of what's really going to bring about those things. And that's that we can only lead from our lack, not from our abundance, right? We can only serve as community by attending first to our own need, listening to where we have our own needs that God wants to fill, and then letting other people see those needs be filled so that we can really listen to others' needs and let them see the power of God in us. And that's especially true when we sit in the kind of abundance and plenty that we have. So let me dive a little more into 1 Kings 8 and give some more context here. So some of you will remember that King David was going to build this temple, but because he wasn't obedient, God took that privilege away and promised to let David's son do it instead. And we heard in Renee's teaching last week how on his deathbed, David tried to impart some wisdom to his son Solomon, or what he thought was wisdom. He said, he counseled Solomon, he says, there's basically a few people who are going to be vying for power when I die, and you better make sure they get killed. It was his way of conveying wisdom to Solomon, which was actually a way to try to help Solomon take control of things instead of letting God be in charge of things. And Solomon tried to not fall into that, but he ended up, as we heard from Renee, he did. He ended up falling into that same way of not relying on God for power. And Solomon even goes on right at the beginning of his reign to marry into the royalty of Egypt. He starts really grasping for all these ways of grabbing power that are not about obedience to God. And so very soon into his reign, Solomon is falling to the same things that David fell to. But when it comes to the temple itself, we see Solomon trying to get some things right again. It's a struggle again, because still, if we look at what leads up to First Kings chapter 8, we see that actually Solomon is spending a lot of time on himself. The temple gets 7 years of dedicated time, but the palace gets 13. And actually the temple is dwarfed by the palace. Solomon's really building something for himself as well. In the language about the building of the palace and the temple, instead of crediting the craftsmen, who are named, and so actually a lot of artists I know really are drawn to these verses, we tend to see a lot of things about how Solomon cast this thing of bronze, or Solomon built this thing. There's a lot about Solomon getting credit for this whole thing. And in fact, we even learn that he relies on slave labor to get all this stuff made, which is a sobering thing to read for a country, a nation, a people founded on escape from slavery in many ways. But on the dedication day, he's trying to get it right. We read that they bring the ark up on the poles as a group. That's the symbolic entry of God and the ark through the Ark of the Covenant into the temple. And he's trying to get something right there. Compare that to how David carted the Ark of the Covenant around, right, on a wagon. And we have actually even talked about in the leadership team a few weeks ago how when David carted the Ark of the Covenant around on a wagon, it started to tip over, and one person tried to keep it from falling off and died. And so one way of thinking about that is that the Ark of the Covenant, the presence of God, needs to be accompanied by a group, not by one person. It's the work of many. And that happens here. The Ark of the Covenant's moved in by the right group of priests. Solomon's following the law. Everyone sees God's glory move into the temple. But the funny thing is that in chapter 8, that moment of God moving into the temple is not the center of the story. The center of the story is Solomon praying. And it's actually accomplished through the very literary function of the thing. So I talked about this before, but there's something that happens a lot in Hebrew literature called a chiasm, where a story is structured as a kind of symmetry that leads to the main event. And in 1 Kings 8, we start with this demonstration of all the wealth and resources on display in verses 1 through 13. The ark has moved in, of course, the greatest privilege that Solomon has. We read that the people are assembled to King Solomon, and we read that there are so many sheep and oxen sacrificed that none could be counted or numbered. It's a huge display of wealth and abundance. Then Solomon addresses the people. Then he addresses the Lord. He addresses the people again, and then there's more wealth and resources on display. And so really, the glory of God is seen at the beginning, not in the middle. So the very story is constructed with Solomon praying to God at the center and not God moving into the temple at the center. And even in these intermediate steps, when he's talking to the people, he's pointing to God, but he's also talking a lot about himself. In 14 through 21, he's saying, "For I have risen in the place of my father David. I sit on the throne of Israel. I have provided a place for the ark." After he prays to God, he says, "Let these words of mine, which I pleaded before the Lord, be near to the Lord our God." And then when we're back to the end, 22,000 oxen, 120,000 sheep. The altar was so small they had to consecrate the center of the court for offerings. Abundance, wealth. There's a lot of display of wealth here. And so when Solomon gets up to pray, I was reminded of, maybe y'all have been in church where there's group prayer, and there's always one person that gets up with a lot of drama, and they're up there and they're really proclaiming and they're really performing their time in the group prayer. And we all bless that person, and we might think, oh wow, they sure are wanting some spotlight for their moment here. Solomon feels like that person who's up there going, "Oh Lord," and the rest of us are kind of going, "Oh Lord," and there's a kind of he's struggling with it. And I think if any particular person comes to mind for you, you know that they probably struggle with it too. And so I think that's really, really there in this prayer. Solomon can't help himself, but he's fighting it. And I think that's what I love about this prayer, as you see him fighting in the middle of this. He does start the prayer with a reference to himself again, but then he pivots off, and it's a long prayer. I wish you could read the whole thing, and almost none of it's about himself, only the beginning. And then it's about everybody else, pleading for mercy for everybody else. And it's moving to read because, written from the time of captivity, the author is writing King Solomon, is actually praying for mercy on the people and that their land be returned to them that they lost as a result of sin. It's very moving. And then at the very center of this prayer, we get this, where Solomon prays, "And as for the foreigner who does not belong to your people, Israel, but has come from a distant land because of your name, for they will hear of your great name and your mighty hand and your outstretched arm. When they come and pray toward this temple, then hear from heaven, your dwelling place. Do whatever the foreigner asks of you, Solomon says to God, so that all the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your own people Israel, and may know that this house I have built bears your name. So in his big showy prayer, in his moment in the spotlight, this leader Solomon pivots from himself, tries to get off, starts thinking about everybody else, pleading for mercy for everyone else, and then he even extends to this figure of this foreigner. It's a really striking picture for me and a bold one to make for God, because this foreigner drawn across all these great distances, just as Solomon drew from all these great resources across distances, what is that foreigner drawn by, and why should we give them attention? They might ask for weird stuff. I mean, they might ask not the right way. They may not be following the ritual. And yet Solomon begs for God, listen to that person as well. The foreigner is drawn by her need. And here, I'm struck by how that need for God that Solomon's imagining is stronger than Solomon's own need for power. There's something where I see him clinging like crazy to that. He's like, oh, Lord, I'm here and I've built myself up. I'm in the spotlight and I kind of like it. I got to find something to cling to that's not just about me. And the strongest thing I think of is the need for God in the person I don't even know. It's a really striking thing. This vision there that there's more power in the needs of others than there can ever be in the world's versions of security or surety or reputation. And to tip towards conclusion here, I wonder if Solomon didn't learn this earlier from another story. The story that launched his reputation as a wise leader, right? The story of his adjudication between these two women who come to him looking for his judgment about an infant that they both claim is their son. Usually this story is lifted up as evidence of Solomon's great wisdom in the way that he adjudicates this, right? He says, well, why don't we cut the baby in half and let you each take half? But we hear that the rightful mother, because compassion for her son burned within her, responds and cries out. And that, of course, resolves the story. And there's a Jesuit scholar named Gina Hens Piazza who points out really how dependent Solomon's whole reputation is on that woman. I mean, it's her compassion and her uncontrollable speaking out of that need to see that baby live that gives Solomon the opportunity to make the judgment at all. And then we read everyone learns about his great wisdom. And I wonder about how much that Solomon's witness of that uncontrollable, that giving in to need, that giving in to love might have struck him in this story. Renee challenged us last week to see wisdom as coming from giving, from sacrifice, instead of from what we usually think of as wisdom, especially in leaders, a sort of removed, dispassionate judgment. And maybe in that way, the mother was bearing witness to Solomon, giving him a crucial glimpse of the only thing that could save him from his own desire to be seen as a good leader and as a wise leader. I think a focus on that kind of that uncontrollable need for God, on the deepest lacks in myself and others, is what's going to save me, I hope, from being a leader that merely likes to be seen as selfless. And I'll be dependent on y'all a lot for that, I am sure. I think it's what might help me be a true servant. And maybe that same attention to lack, especially in the stranger, to need in the stranger, is what will help our church be of true service to this community. And indeed, hearing the history of this church through stories like Jim and Barbara's, I'm struck by how this church's story has been one of growing as a place that attracted people who had needs. It was people seem to be drawn to these other spaces this church has been in, the way the foreigner is drawn to the temple in Solomon's prayer. Today's lectionary also includes the story in the Gospel of John, where Christ first explains communion to his disciples. And he's showing them how he's going to have to lose his life for them to gain it, and they can't comprehend it. They don't get it. It doesn't make any sense to them. Maybe the same way it doesn't make sense for a king who has everything, like Solomon, and his moment in the spotlight to be conjuring for us a person with a deep hole in their life, this foreigner. But isn't that what we try to center on every week at the communion tables, is that lack? So as we move to the tables here, as we all move there, I hope we can think about surrendering all the ways we think we can be effective, all the ways we think we can be selfless or wise. And I would invite you to call to mind the deep needs within yourselves for God and the equally deep needs among our neighbors, those needs that are going to draw them here as we let God's work within our needs shine out. So let's move to the tables now, like that foreigner drawn to the temple, out of control, really, and let God live in us as temples, as testaments, shining like gold to the world, as testaments to God's desire to meet every person in their deepest lacks.